cybersecurity is pretty firmly on the agenda for most boards and governing bodies now. One of the things that helps is just building up that education and awareness, and sometimes it's down to simple things like reporting. So starting to build the literacy around what are the things that we should care about from a security point of view, and what are sort of some of the health indicators that tell us, are we on the right track or have we got some gaps? And I think one of the things we often face is that people simply don't know.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the latest episode of Upwards. Today I'm joined by special guest Mike Carroll from Brightly. Mike has been an IT professional for over 20 years and is founder and principal consultant at Brightly, one of New Zealand's first, or if the first, B Corp certified IT services company, I believe. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for coming on the show.
Good, Phil. Thanks for having me.
No worries. We're going to dig into that B Corp thing a little bit later on in the episode. I'm very keen to kind of hear how you arrived at that journey and what that's been all about. But welcome, listeners, to Upwards. This is a podcast for tech security leaders. We focus on sort of the intersection of security, leadership, and privacy, and also startups world a bit as well. So that's what we're all about. And I'm really stoked to be talking to Mike from Brightly. Brightly are a partner of ours. We have a couple of people in that sort of special status in our world. Mike looks after a number of different companies. He's an all-around great guy and is on a really cool mission to do some good in the world, which I'm sure he'll share a little bit about as well. So welcome again, Mike. It's great to have you on the show. And we'll get stuck in. What do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey? You know, you've been around a little while in this industry, been through different sorts of companies, you've ended up founding Brightly. Can you tell us how you got to where you are now and what Brightly is all about?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess my background wasn't originally in tech. I studied geography and environmental sciences, interested in that side of the world. But one of my early, I'd had some job experience working in IT and was able to gain an initial position with a local IT company providing services into local government, and so started learning on the job and never really looked back. So had a career across service providers, consulting, and then working within the media environment, running IT in that space as well. Lots of really, really good experience, which was some great companies, some challenging times and a lot of things learned the hard way. But yeah, really experienced some great company culture and kind of interesting spaces to work in. And then got to a stage where I suppose we sort of, some of the ways in which IT services were delivered to the organizations we worked for and some of the other things we saw in the market, as well as, I suppose, personal values and the change you wanted to see in the world, decided to take the opportunity to kind of step out and, start doing our own thing and building a company that could do things maybe a little bit differently.
Yeah, I really like that. And tell me a little bit about, you know, the values side of things. I don't know, this is sort of a personal thing for you as much as a business, you know, venture. And this led to you, I assume, becoming B Corp certified. Tell us a bit about that. How does that change you from a sort of perhaps more of a traditional IT services business to who you are?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I guess fundamentally what it comes down to is that I see some global challenges in terms of climate is probably one of the biggest examples there. And I think if you're based in Auckland like we are, that's been pretty forefront or really throughout Aotearoa. And other challenges as well in terms of social equity and community. And I think whether it's looking ahead to the world that our kids will inherit or just the wanting to look back at what we've achieved, I don't want to be in a position where I've kind of put my head in the sand around what some of those challenges look like and what we could have done about them. And in the past, working within different organizations, I might have been on the green team or I've done some volunteering, and all of that's been really good and useful stuff. But what I wanted to try and do was show that you can actually run a profitable business, taking into account all of your impact, working to have a positive impact overall. And so bringing, you know, and starting the company, it was an opportunity to bring those personal values together with what I could do, which was the technology side of things. And so it's not always straightforward and definitely not perfect. There's a lot of compromises that we have to make, but we try and hold a line around that. And the way that it's worked out for us, that we look in terms of our impact, is the way that we run the company. So first and foremost, walking the talk and running a really responsible company in terms of our impact, in terms of how the way we look after our team, and just, you know, doing a good job of that. The second area we look at is the way that we're working with our customers. So really trying to educate people. It might be simple things around like e-waste and being proactive about taking care of that, or how people can use technology to improve their impact, drive efficiency, reduce travel, all of those kind of normal sorts of things. And then the third aspect is what we call direct impact. So we donate 1% of our revenue to nonprofits, and then we work in with nonprofits and social enterprises providing discounted services and pro bono time, because they're the ones out there kind of doing the hard yards. And if we can support them, then that, again, scales our impact a lot more than, you know, what we can do as a team.
I really like that. I like that sort of thinking around, you know, through your efforts, you actually scale that impact quite heavily, don't you? I mean, in terms of supporting these companies to do what they're doing. You know, it's a big challenge, and you know, technology can make a huge difference on our environmental impact. You know, I mean, we all over COVID, you stopped driving cars and stopped flying to meet venture capitalists in the US and had these meetings online, and we found a way to make it work. And you know, be not sure if any studies have quite released this yet, but the collective environmental reduction in emissions over that time would be quite interesting to see, you know, because we all just employed technology because we didn't have a choice.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, there were noticeable impacts in air quality almost immediately. So there's definitely 100% potential out there. Yeah.
I remember the first week of lockdown here in, you know, Auckland, and you know, the roads were just completely empty. There was you could go hours without seeing a car, and, you know, I'd sort of do the local walk around the suburb, and something was different. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but I realized there was no noise coming from the city, hardly any noise. And it was quite dramatic because there's just always noise, like a big hum. And this is, you know, across a big body of water too. It's not sort of like right there. So, you know, it was quite startling to sort of realize actually how much of that is just constantly there. And we don't even realize. So you look after sort of startups and some, you know, and nonprofits, and I suppose lots of different types of businesses. What do you see as some of the unique challenges, you know, maybe in the tech sort of world that you're seeing around, you know, that facing around sort of some of the security challenges that they're facing at the moment?
Yeah, it's a pretty challenging space overall, I think, particularly for nonprofits and smaller organizations where there are limited resources, and whether that's in terms of people, time, money, and often the priority in the day job is not necessarily about technology. It's about running a profitable business, running a nonprofit that's, you know, generating impact. And technology provides a supporting function there, but it's often sort of behind the scenes. And so security can be a bit of a afterthought in many cases. And it's just hard to stay on top of in terms of it's fast moving, the threats, you know, without scaremongering, the people that are out there trying to make money out of compromising other people's systems are highly motivated and they've got a lot of resources. And so that constantly shifting kind of environment is quite challenging. And I think the one of the biggest ones is just the user education piece. It's just around, you know, helping organizations understand their responsibility, that it's not just something that sits with IT, and that, you know, you need as much as you need the tools and kind of technical controls in there, you need the process and the education side of it as well. And that's often, you know, we'll have people looking for a magic wand for security in terms of, hey, you know, what can we plug in that'll kind of make us safe? And it's like, well, yes, there are things that'll help in some aspects, but a lot of it, actually, you've got to do some heavy lifting and look at the way that you work and building that awareness amongst your team.
Yeah, yeah. And I often come into that as well. And it's easy as technical folks as well, particularly we tend to think technology is the answer to everything. We just roll out this piece of software or this, you know, this device, or turn something on here, it's going to fix everything. But you know, as we know with lots of things, that's not really the case. How have you found, you know, because I guess, you know, in your world, you've got very technical things that you're doing, you know, things you're provisioning, rolling out, deprovisioning, configuring all that sort of stuff. But then you've got the very human sort of soft skill challenges of sometimes having to have a, you know, difficult conversation with a key kind of leader about the nature of something. You know, how have you found, you know, what are some tips you've found doing that well, perhaps, and how, you know, how would you encourage other people to perhaps do that in their world if they're in a position where they need to, you know, influence, sometimes manage up in some cases, sometimes yep. manage across or even down, but, you know, to actually make organizational change real.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, and it does depend a lot on the particular organization and where they're at in the journey. One of the things that's helped a lot recently is that cybersecurity is pretty firmly on the agenda for most boards and governing bodies now. And as yet, although often we don't have a particularly mature process around that. So sometimes one of the things that helps is just building up that education and awareness. And sometimes it's down to simple things like reporting. So starting to build the literacy around what are the things that we should care about from a security point of view, and what are sort of some of the health indicators that tell us, are we on the right track, or have we got some gaps? And I think one of the things we often face is that people simply don't know. They're not aware of the level of challenge they might be facing around the gaps within their own organization. And if it's an environment where that hasn't been the culture in the past or hasn't been bedded into processes, often people are a bit resistant to being honest with themselves about how deep some of those gaps can be. So starting on that education journey, being really honest and transparent around kind of what that looks like and what the repercussions can be. One of the interesting things we've found is that often now people have personal experience of fraud and of cybersecurity issues. And so if an executive or a senior leader has had a text or a smishing fraud, or they've had an email compromise, they'll have a much better affinity for the level of problem and pain that can bring. And just, yeah, coming back, even if it's other organizations, or walking through the types of scenarios that can happen, and not in a fear-mongering way. Like, I don't think creating a whole bunch of scare or fear amongst the community really helps, but around building that awareness, that understanding, walking through a scenario of, you know, if your 365 environment has been compromised, this is what it can mean. And these are the sorts of things that help you kind of A, prevent that from happening, and B, have an adequate response if it does. So I think, yeah, the primary things are education, having the conversation, and just trying to build up that transparency around it. And that wherever possible, creating that safe zone to be able to say, look, you know, this is where we're at today. We know we need to improve. These are the gaps we've identified. There'll be other things that come out over time, but here's where we're starting, and this is where we're trying to get to.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, isn't it? It's a governance conversation. You know, they don't expect everything to be perfect straight away, but they want to know. Ideally, it's better to talk about the truth and to talk in real terms so you can actually devise a plan and do something about that than it is to sort of either just kind of ignore it or misrepresent. How it is, yeah. Without being sort of sensationalizing things, it's just about to talk in real terms. Yeah. In that reporting, are you sometimes talking, you know, at a direct level of a company or a board level?
Yeah, absolutely. And what quite often helps there is working with existing frameworks. So if they've got a risk management structure already, mapping that through in terms of how you're then feeding up cybersecurity risks. They won't want to know the nitty gritty detail of your patching strategy or your vulnerability management, but understanding at a high level, you know, this is the health. And if you're using an industry standard, or you've got, you know, your own methodology, just ensuring that you're aligning it to what the organization understands as a major risk. And that when they look at that report, they can kind of look at it in their own terms from a governance perspective of, you know, what's material, what do I need to prioritize, what level of investment might be needed.
Yeah, indeed. You know, because we deal a lot with startups, what are some of the particular challenges that you see, you know, that maybe are unique to just startups when it comes to this stuff? You know, we sort of talked a little bit about time and resources can be, you know, a little bit constrained, attention can be constrained. Is there any things, what would you suggest, you know, startups do you know, to just kind of start out, you know, as they're getting off the ground?
I think there are some unique challenges. I think when you're wanting to ship a product, that becomes, you know, the cadence and the need to fulfill that market requirement and be first to market is really a strong impetus. Mm-hmm. And the challenge we see with that is development teams that have not baked security into that process, it then becomes an afterthought and it becomes much harder to retrofit. So the often the culture in a startup is, you know, get it out the door, focus on the customer, and that's fantastic. But it does need that discipline around thinking about security from an architecture point of view initially and then in practices, because going back to fix gaps afterwards is a lot harder than baking it into the process. And so that developer education and the culture around that is really important. It's not about breaks on everything. It's just kind of having those checks and balances in place.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard to change the culture. It's hard to change the code, and it can be done, but it's like turning around the bigger ship, but it's a lot harder. One of the parallels perhaps to this, you know, the software development world was a long time ago, you know, unit tests and automated tests used to be sort of a kind of a nice to have, maybe we'll get around to it. We're a startup, we don't do unit tests, you know, sort of deal. And so the classic scenario was, you know, this product which is developed and it's got lots of scar tissue and it's sort of a bit of a mess and it's got no tests. And maybe they thought one day they'd just throw it away and rewrite it all. But often products have a habit of existing a lot longer than they originally thought they would. And gradually what we've seen is a maturation in people's understanding and tooling and just culture and know-how to actually write tests more as they go and to bake that sort of thing into the software development lifecycle. Not everyone's perfect. Some people are probably sure are looking after codebases, brand new codebases with zero tests, but it's a lot more achievable now. And I'd say that a lot of people would do that from the get-go. And that's happened over sort of decades of maturation in this space. And so I kind of see security and to some degree privacy actually following a similar path where we're kind of in that early stage of like where it's getting better. It's built into some aspects of people, but we've still got a wee way to go in terms of really getting to the point where it's not just an afterthought anymore. It's not just something we charge clients extra for, but it's actually part of you know, the way that we develop software and develop our tech stacks and in the way that we build our organizations as well. Just like we all do, you know, we all do these things that have been around a long time without questioning them. And my hope is that the security and privacy eventually gets to that point. Same as you build it into an organization early on, you know, 2-3 people need to start thinking about it. One person needs to start thinking about it. And then if you quickly go to 10 and 20 and 50 people, you still have a lot to change, but it becomes a little bit more, the culture hopefully carries some of that momentum with it. And you get there in better shape than you might have done otherwise.
Yeah, that's right. And the earlier you start on that journey, the better. And again, you know, as with the, I think the test analogy is a great one, the tools and the processes to support that are improving the security space as well. And so kind of, again, looking for not every single person reinventing the wheel, kind of, using platforms to support it too is a great way to go.
Yeah, indeed. So in terms of, you know, we've talked a little bit about startups and what they need to, you know, they need their next challenges. Are there, you know, what are some practical tips for building, you know, perhaps building this into your culture? You know, like we talk about the tech side of things a lot, but the people side of things, like if you're dealing with, say, a 3 or a 5 or a 10 person company, what are some things you've seen that perhaps they can start doing from a sort of culture and process perspective when it comes to things like thinking about security and privacy?
Yeah, I think often there's two key parts to that for us. One is, as you alluded to, with the kind of governance approach, it's starting at the top and ensuring that the leadership understand and are committed to this being a part of the culture. If they're not, then it's kind of an uphill battle. And the other end of that is with the onboarding process. So when you're onboarding a new team member, just ensuring that, you know, you set them up with their phone, you set them up with their device. There's a security conversation that starts then, basically, and it continues all the way through. And just all of the small things. So often we run into environments where people are sharing passwords or they're sending them via email. And it's just kind of what's acceptable and how you build those habits up around, you know, think about these things. If it's sensitive data, it should be encrypted. If it's a password, it shouldn't be shared. All of those things, you can have your, you know, 16-page security policy, and you should have hopefully a more condensed and user-friendly one, but you need to have the culture and the practice around it, and just kind of that ensuring the leadership team are leading by example and are calling out things. It's like, well, that doesn't look like the way we do things. And the other side of that too is around, comes back to the trust and transparency. So ensuring that the culture is there, that if something goes wrong, the very worst thing is for people to put their head in the sand or to not communicate about it. Mm-hmm. And so that's a key part of the kind of aspect for us is, you're 100% better knowing early that there's been an incident or that someone's worried about something than you are kind of finding out late and dealing with it when it's more urgent and a bigger problem.
Yeah, indeed. I really like that. I love that sort of starting from the top thing, you know, getting the leaders of the business to really buy into this as a thing that's going to have some level of priority, but B, actually practice that as well. I mean, if those things are in place, like you say, there's a much better chance of the organization actually succeeding. And you know, we sort of say here at Omelie that security is a team sport. It's not just a lone wolf, you know, person having to sort of, you know, scratch away at it, you know, somewhere in the organization. That's actually something that everyone's part of. And the more people you can have involved in thinking about and celebrating and doing that, then the more likelihood you are to see a company actually succeed and avoid some of the most common types of mistakes that are made. Yeah,
that's a great point. And something as a managed service provider, you know, we're always looking at how we improve the communication, the education around that, because depending on the services that we provide for a customer, it's a bit like the cloud providers. There's a shared responsibility kind of model. And depending on what we're providing, we'll take on a bit more responsibility around the cybersecurity. But it's never just our responsibility and it's never just the customers. And so building that sort of understanding is really, really key, because otherwise, again, it's that environment. It's like, oh, they're taking care of it. We don't need to worry about it anymore. And it's like, well, it's never quite like that. You know, you always need that education. You always need that awareness.
I don't think, I've heard people sort of say something, some variations of, I wish I could just outsource this or make this is somebody else's problem. And that sounds cool, nice in theory, I'll just pay someone to do this. But actually it needs to be owned culturally from the company. You know, you can't truly really outsource it. You can have people that come in and help you achieve it. But ultimately, if you don't own an ethical organization, then those people are not going to own it for you. You just can't do that. And so I think that's something that I see a wee bit that probably people, you know, need to kind of think about it differently, is that you need to just kind of own it ultimately from the top, regardless of who actually implements it for you. It has to be something that's, you know, that's a culture. It's a culture thing for the best, you know, the best result possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, you should absolutely talk to people that are professionals that can help you. That is really useful. And it's probably a good idea if you don't have the confidence internally to do that. But ultimately, what they should be doing is helping you own that and set it up so that culturally it's a thing.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, again, the reality is with the skill sets out there and the deeper into cybersecurity you go, there are some really specialist skills, and most organizations are never going to hire or own those internally. So though bringing those people in is fantastic and it really necessary in a lot of cases. But you're right, it's not about giving away the responsibility. It's about sharing it and bringing in the expertise and the teams and the tools that you need.
Cool. So look, if you're running a startup, if you're a lean and mean team, you know, I encourage you to start thinking about taking ownership of this, even if it's starting to procure the right sort of tools and resources that you need, even doing some of the basic stuff, but talk about it as a team, recruit people to help, as a team to help onboard new people in the right way. I think that's really, really bang on, making sure people are set up well from the beginning, because they'll never, you know, you have a small window of opportunity to kind of sort of shock them into your culture and the way of doing things when someone first joins an organization. And if, you know, they know that this is what they need to do with passwords, they're more likely to sort of follow that from that point forward. So I encourage you to do that as well. Well, look, Mike, we're at time. So thank you again for coming on the show today. It's been really insightful and hearing about your journey, about your world, and some really smart sort of tips that people can sort of take away and apply to their own business. So thank you.
Thanks all. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
This is Upwards, the podcast for security and tech leaders, brought to you by Onwardly. Don't forget to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next time for more on security, startups, and leadership.